this morning with the sun down shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sun down.
Well, I'm off Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howard. Ricky on the board. S&P futures down 11. NASDAQ futures up down 83. Little bit of a give back of the huge up day yesterday. we're a little late. The traffic is still reeling from our first winter storm of the year, but better today, and it's getting a little warmer, so there you go. Do we have Professor Carl?
You do. And, yeah, welcome to what I fully expect is going to be a winter full of white stuff.
We don't have a Phoenix studio, so you better be wrong.
Well, I got news for you. How wrong was I about no landfalling hurricanes?
You're pretty good about that.
Okay.
Of course, if you were
just saying,
if you were the one place, they didn't like it too much.
Well, I didn't say no hurricanes. That would have been a stupid statement.
Yes.
That would have been an absolutely stupid statement, because that's never going to be the case. And yeah, so I mean, if you were Jamaica, you are not happy.
By the way, that thing Miss Bermuda was kind of heading right toward it.
Yeah, well, Bermuda's kind of in a funny spot, because they get hit pretty frequently with you know, just because of the recurvature, they're in the path, right? So the you know, what drives those things poleward is the Coriolis force and the, you know, and the rotation. And the reason that you had the pattern change this year is because unlike some people that are saying, oh, you know, no, it's climate change. No, it's just that the ENSO was neutral, and I saw the jet amplitude pattern setting up that was not going to have the excursion south to the degree that we usually do, and those are the things that force those storms west. Okay, so that at the same time, that pattern, so that's also why you had those heat domes set up and sit there for 2 weeks at a time.
Okay, yeah.
I mean that
yeah, it all kind of ties together, obviously.
Yeah, it all kind of connects, but it inhibits the formation of storms in the Gulf as well, because you need ventilation, you need the heat that rises and it gets pulled up, that builds those storms, has to have something that takes it out of there. All right. Otherwise, the intensification doesn't happen. So
yeah, I was kind of saying, when you first said that, I kind of looked at where you were coming from and stuff you wrote, and I was pretty much on board. I still thought we might get one of those pop-up jobs in the Gulf, just because the water was too so warm. That would,
well, you never. I mean, you know, it's an odds thing, right? I mean, there was no guarantee that I was going to end up being right. All it takes is one that defies the probabilities, and you get hammered, right? I mean, that's Jamaica got it. But the fact that it was going to tend to shift them more towards the north. And keep them from coming, especially the long track storms coming off of Africa, coming over here and getting the United States was.
Yeah, those are really bizarre, where they start out really in Africa and then they drop what are the lizards and stuff? They drop all over everybody. They pick up all that stuff off the ground. And they drop, if you're going by there in a boat, they're landing insects on you.
Yeah, I mean, it's some pretty bizarre stuff, you know. It's the funny thing about it is that one of the odd meteorological things is that we had the swine flu pandemic after World War I, right? That was brought back into the United States, but there were islands at the time that had absolutely no commerce, no outside commerce, so there was no ship traffic coming into them, right? And you would think that such a place would essentially be immune to a viral pandemic that goes ripping through the rest of the world because, you know, there's no humans, right? There's no human contact. Well, you'd be wrong. It ended up getting them anyway. And it points out the folly that we have with a lot of the things that we think we can control. And in fact, we can't. I mean, you would expect that the way that contamination happens is, the ship docks and some poor SOB that's on there has it and, seeds it into the population. Not necessarily. So, yeah.
Well, the bubonic plague, as it raced across Europe, and this is like so disgusting, that it was really a movement in the rat population.
Right. Well, it was actually the fleas. But yeah, and on the rats.
Yeah, and so if you had a farm someplace, all of a sudden you got it, were dead in a couple of days, and animals were still like tied up, and cows didn't get milked and blew up, and it was about as disgusting, most painful thing for people and livestock that ever. I mean, just you don't even want to think about it. Pretty bizarre.
Yeah, it was it's. It's funny how some of those things work. So, hey...
Actually, but on a final note there, somebody writes into Quora and goes, how come people today, if the plague gets out, people don't, it doesn't cause the same kind of deaths that it used to? And the answer was interesting. It said, well, if you're here and you came anywhere from anywhere, chances are one of your family members somewhere along the line, great-great-great-grandpa Carl, was a survivor.
Right.
Which I never thought of that.
Well, that's one of the things that is sort of a gotcha on that, which by the way, points out the folly of our tampering with things, like, for example, playing with mRNA-type stuff, is that we do not understand how that ends up getting passed generationally, how that sort of resistance. And yet we know it's true because it even back, way, 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 way back, right, when the white man came into the so-called New World, measles was endemic in Europe, okay? It had, been around forever. But not over here, and today measles is still fairly dangerous. It'll whack you one or two out of 1,000 times, right? But back then it was, it was maybe 4 or 5 times.
Well, if you don't have a 50s or 60s mom, and you were in a army camp in the Civil War, it was way more than 2 in 1,000.
Oh yeah. But I'm saying, but the thing is that when white people brought that into the so-called New World, the death rate among the native people that were here was extraordinarily high.
Oh, I would imagine, yeah.
And because they had absolutely zero genetically passed down resistance to it. It had never been in this part of the world before. And so, I mean, it's kind of fun.
I think the only disease... the white man showed up.
Chief, the point kind of is, we think we're so smart, okay?
Yeah, well,
we're really not. If somebody is
supposedly smart, all they think about is the stuff they don't know. If you're a dope, all you think is about stuff you do know.
Yeah, exactly. So, the Senate got made, the Democrats, at least enough of them anyway, got made an offer they couldn't refuse. You know, Schumer got absolutely nothing out of this, you know, this shutdown thing.
That's good? Business as usual?
Well, you know, I don't think it's good at all for a couple of reasons. But I the one good thing that I do think may come out of this, and it's not odds on. Okay, so I would not be placing bets in the market based on this.
What do you mean? Although, we went up 800 points in 12 hours.
No. I'm talking about where I think this goes next.
Oh,
yes,
right.
I know we're up 800 points in 12 hours. What I'm talking about is the health insurance stuff, the fact that he got nothing there, and that this, you know, as I have pointed out now for all the way back to before Obamacare became a thing, back when I was running MCS, you can't solve a cost problem with an insurance scheme, and yet Trump has now proved, whether people, you know, love him, hate him, whatever, he has now proved 80% reduction in costs that I've been talking about for a long time is real. And in fact, there's this stuff with Ozempic, right? So...
Trump RX.
Well, you know, whatever. I know everybody wants to put their own name on it, right?
Because No. One person does.
Well, I'd say he's got to take credit for it because, you know, it's the way it is. But the reality of it is that if Congress on both sides of the aisle is bought and paid for to a degree that you are never going to see this voluntarily come out of them, all right? But if he was to turn around and tell Blondie, along with Patel and...
Don't ever anticipate him doing anything intelligent, Colonel. Don't ever.
You know what? If he doesn't, okay, and if he manages to get Congress to follow through on issuing $2,000 checks with his so-called tariff dividend, and you know, all the threats he's issuing now that, there'll be $3 trillion worth of economic dislocation and you know, destabilize the global order and our trade balance and da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, okay, you know, you go ahead and threaten the Supreme Court, see how well it works out. But the thing is that if he gets backed into a corner where he actually frog marches a half dozen insurance company and pharmaceutical and hospital executives, you could actually see this problem get solved.
No way.
Okay, well, you know what? Let me tell you something. I wrote an article on this, I sent it off to the list. I just got back into town this last week from a, you know, go see live music trip, okay? And I ran into this couple at a bar as I was getting nicely lubricated for the upcoming show because the bar was cheaper than, you know, buying the drinks in the theater. And a very nice couple, probably 20 years younger than me. And she worked for an insurance company, works for one. Her and her husband live in a very, I don't know exactly where downtown, but obviously if you live in the middle of a fairly large city in a high-rise condo or apartment, you are well into the six figures of income because that's the only way you can afford to do that kind of thing. And they were down there carousing and whooping it up and, you know, drinking. They were not going to the show. They were just down there having a good time. And she point blank stated that her job was to negotiate up the price. Not down the price, up the price.
Well, sure.
And I said, well, yeah, and oh, by the way,
that's what people with a concentration issue or monopoly do.
Well, duh. And so, you know, here we are. And by the way, also fully aware that why they didn't want anybody using, horsey stuff during the crazy because of the signal that might have, I mean, I don't know that it would have, but might have shown up. They were very afraid of that. That was the motivation. She was not at all surprised that although you can buy that stuff over the counter now in Tennessee, it's $10 a pill, but the veterinary formulations are 25 cents. So even though you can buy it over the counter, the monopolist pricing
is
still there.
My doctor told me the price for her of a epileptic, what do they call it? Anaphylactic.
The EpiPens?
No, anaphylactic shot. If you were to go into her place and she stuck it in your behind,
Right.
It's a buck and a half. It costs her an EpiPen $600.
$600, right. And this is all throughout the system. It's
but it's a patent issue. it's all kinds of issues.
Well, but here's the thing. If you go after 15 USC, which has stood again, and as I've pointed out, not only has it stood on the books for over 100 years, in 1979, the Supreme Court went to the question, directly to the question, of whether or not insurance companies had immunity under McCarran-Ferguson in the health sector.
They don't. We know they don't.
They do not. And they don't. And the reason they don't is that if you have the ability to act as a cartel, you will force prices higher.
Carl, let me back up on this, and I want to kind of get on more on the veterans team here because these guys are coming in a bit. But what Carl's talking about, if I can get this frog out of my throat, is insurance companies were given, based on this law, the ability to sort of share information on if somebody had a bunch of car accidents and things like that.
Correct. That's
and they have the ability to charge different rates based on whether you're a smoker or not a smoker, those kinds of things. And then the insurance companies have taken the next step, sort of like the National Football League, which is not a monopoly, but act like one. They've taken the next step and saying, okay, well, we get to fix prices on the other end, which they don't, according to that thing. And the Supreme Court said it, is it once or twice? But still, they do it anyway.
Right. And oh, by the way, that's not it. And the reason the Sherman and Clayton Acts were written as criminal felonies, not just fines.
Carl, you're talking to two people, you and me, to even know what those are now.
Well, I'm just saying, the reason there are criminal penalties in that law is because if you are a cartel...
The last time the criminal penalty was used, you weren't even alive.
I understand that, but the reason they're there is that if you're a cartel and you get fined, you will just simply make the customers pay the fine.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But you can't make a customer pay a prison sentence. You got to go serve it.
Well, we can talk about that all we want, but it's not... The thing that has me disgusted about this whole thing with the Trump RX, it's the same crap as Biden did with the 10 drugs for Medicare.
Right.
The fact is, I'd like to see the government pay less, but a third grader would say, given the power these people have, if the government pays less, the rest of the people are just going to pay more.
Well, that's right. It has to be everybody.
It has to be everybody. And Trump's not going there. Biden's not going there. Nobody's going there.
Well, you know what? You know what? All right, so here's the thing. You know where it's going to go, all right? And this was the interesting
thing. It's going to go. We're broke. That's where it's going.
No, I'll tell you where it's going to go. This woman actually said to me in the bar, sitting there, Luigi's going to get off. She led with that. I didn't ask.
Well, what do you mean by get off?
Walk.
He's not going to walk. No way.
Well, you know what? She expects that. And furthermore, what that
she's in a she's
is,
in a bar.
Well, I understand that, and she's probably wrong, right? But there's going to be a lot of Luigis if this doesn't stop.
Well, I guess that's the solution, but I don't think so.
Well, I don't like that solution. But maybe these politicians ought to think about the fact that when you put people in a box and you tell them, oh, by the way, you're going to die.
Well, what's the difference between that and them waiting forever or not paying people for hurricanes? One of my friends at the time, I haven't seen him in ages, used to work for an insurance company. He goes, we're very, very good at collecting. We're pretty darn good at investing. We're really awful on paying.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah.
you can talk to me about that. I had a friend of mine whose house got wrecked during Ivan by an embedded... It wasn't even... Well, I mean, it was windstorm. It was an embedded tornado that lifted the roof off her house, broke all the seals, and then dropped it back down there. So it didn't, like, tear it off and throw it in the street, but it broke all the seals, okay? And of course, then what happens, there's a hurricane on, it rains in the house for 8 hours, right?
Yeah, and they're going to say whatever it was.
Oh, no, it was clearly a covered peril, okay, under her insurance. It was nearly 2 years before she was back in the place because they jacked her around for the first year.
Well, I don't know the full story, but the guy I used to, this sounds really weird, I used to sort of share a spot with in the OEX.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that? These two guys standing on each other's head. we had a spot that was, you could put two people there if you wanted to, right?
Yeah, I got you. Yeah.
So he went down, he played every opening. If he made a few bucks, he'd go play basketball, maybe not come back. Yeah. I'd show up at 10 o'clock, and I wouldn't leave till the close, because I could never leave and come back, when I had positions on. And anyway, his parents had a condo somewhere down on the Red Deck Riviera. Was it Biloxi?
I used to live with, we used to call it the Red Deck Riviera.
Well, whatever. It was on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, I think.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And so this hurricane hits, this is 20 years ago. We're still in a pit. And they go down there, and everybody's evacuated. And they were, there's the Gulf, there's a good-sized beach. There's crap on that side of the street. I don't know what was over there. And then there's a street, then there's a parking lot, and there's their place. Sort of the typical thing. And everybody evacuates. They go down there, and the place is gone.
Right.
It's gone. There's a slab, right?
Oh, yeah. No, that's, well...
Now, the question is, what happened to your underwear? What happened to the clock on the wall? Nobody seems to know. What happened to your TV?
The underwear is about 3 miles inland.
Yeah. I mean, everybody, so then it was like, they were years. The insurance company, even though nobody saw it, they claimed it was a water surge and not wind, and that wasn't covered. Right. And anyway, they ended up, I'm going to say, 4 or 5 years later, getting like 45 cents on the buck. And the thing was never rebuilt, I don't think.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, there's all sorts of really, really stupid. I mean...
So if you have a mortgage, you owe the rest of the mortgage, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Of course. But, and then you have this little problem. It's called you owe them, but you don't have anything there anymore.
Yeah.
The thing about this, and this is essentially the issue that we have, is that you can never allow a third party into pricing. Okay, the price has to be something that the provider of a thing.
All right, Carl, we're on our schedule here for the VA stuff. Let's on this to Friday. I'm glad you made it back from your trip in one piece.
Yeah.
You were driving, or not flying, right?
I would have not, with the list last week or so, I would not have wanted to be in the air.
Well, let's go right. We have Joel is off. We have one of his, he said he's going to send me one of two guys. I don't know which one we end up with. And we're going to talk about the market. And then we have, at quarter two, we're going to have Kenny Pulcheri, Diane Kelly, a lady named Talia DeSantos, who's working with the Headstrong Project. It's going to be a veterans thing till probably 7:20. Then our man Hal's going to come out and talk about, economics in the market. And also, Hal being a veteran, we'll talk about some of that as well, as a guy who spent, what do you say, Carol? 43 days in 93 degree water in the Gulf. Nobody could shower. No fresh water. Good Lord.
Oh yeah, no, it's a real deal, and this is the day that we give thanks to all the people that served.
So what happened to Hal? The mental issues made him become an Australian genius economist.
I'm here. I just got in my office.
Well, please hang in for this. We have we're talking about the market for 15 minutes, Hal. Then we're going to go to our veteran stuff. And, okay. Feel free to opine in, but we have people from MedStrong, we have people from the Russell House, we have all kinds of stuff. Then you can help me sum it up when everybody's gone. How does that sound?
Okay, sounds good.
So what do we have right now, Ricky?
So we have Talia and we have Hal, so maybe we should go on break real quick.
Yeah, but I thought maybe one of Joel's guys is calling in, but if he doesn't, we'll just go straight to these guys. SP Futures down 13, NASDAQ Futures 94. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now.
Hello, don't bank Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Ollie's Ricky on the board. SP Futures down 12. NASDAQ Futures down 92. We'll do this full one at 7:30. But right now, that's kind of, we're up, we're down a little bit. We're up so much yesterday, just as a review, in case you didn't check your stuff yesterday. You had a good day. S&P's were up 103, NASDAQ up 522. NASDAQ was probably up 1,000 points since noon on Friday when the news of this thing was was piling by. But you said we already have Talia? Is that what you said, Ricky?
Yes, Chief, we do have Talia.
Talia, how are you? This time how?
Yeah, it's Talia Dos Santos. Great to be here, y'all. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're going to go early with you, if you don't mind. But just to, I don't know what Kenny mentioned to you. Kenny usually comes on a quarter or two, but we're kind of balled up here today, which is fine. This all started. We have a lady who I've known for a while named Diane Kelly, who'll be on at 15 minutes as well.
Awesome.
That volunteers at the VA here in Chicago, or in Hines. It's out in Maywood, actually. And that's a VA facility that, I mean, they do everything, but basically they're saddled with a lot of cancer people from Vietnam. They're saddled with a lot of prosthetics. They do that kind of stuff. And she became head of this Fisher House thing in Illinois. And they built a new one up at the Great Lakes, which is also dealing with a lot of active duty people, because that's where the naval, I guess, basic training is. And she says they're branching into this psychology area, because a lot of people, a lot of the veterans have issues, and some of the active duty people have issues. So that's become one of the things they're trying to build up there. It just so happened, Kenny was on the next day, and he goes, hey, by the way, we just did this fundraiser for this psychology group, that Headstrong, that helps out vets that have mental issues, not just physical. And then it just so happens, one of my roommates from college is a psychologist that was in the Army, and the Army's the one who put him through school in psychology. So he came on.
Wow.
And this all is kind of run, it's like a snowball going downhill here. And
small world.
And he was talking about all the different types of, battle fatigue, PTA, whatever you want to call it, and it's every war is sort of different. A lot of it is personal issues. A lot of it is when you come home, there's no family. There's all kinds of, there's not as many organizations for people to fall into as there was 40 years ago. He says it's a huge level, and he talked for an hour, and he could have been 4 hours. I mean, that's how much.
Oh yeah.
And so then I decided, okay, let's get Kenny and you guys back on, and kind of, we're trying to put together almost like a tape of everybody together. I mean, it's not going to be, because I think it's really educational. But where does your group fit in? Are you?
Wait, Tom, can I jump in?
Yeah, please jump in.
Good morning, and thank you, and welcome, and Talia, thank you for joining us today. And I just want to, Tom and I do this once a week. We talk about, stocks all the time, because it's our usual Tuesday event. But today we're talking veterans, because it is Veterans Day, and so we want to thank our veterans for their service. Certainly Talia, that I want to just spend 2 minutes and introduce, so people understand the role that she played in our military and the role that she played in Afghanistan. She is a U.S. Air Force veteran. She served 6 years as a Chinese, a Pashto, a French cryptologic language analyst in Afghanistan, supporting our troops in Afghanistan. She's received the Air Force Medal Achievement Award for identifying an enemy threat that could have cost the lives of 75 Navy SEALs and other special elite forces.
Wow.
Right? She was named the 2013 Airman of the Year at both the squadron and group level. She's a graduate of Columbia University, of course she is, and she began her civilian career in social impact and corporate communications. She is now, today, currently, and I'm it is my honor to serve with her. She is Vice President of Revenue Operations and Program Development at the Headstrong Project, which is, as you know, that organization that I'm a board member of that supports veterans. What started out as returning 9/11 veterans has now included all veterans that suffer from the hidden wounds of war, which are the mental wounds of war, that the PTSD wounds of war that cause these men and women to take their own lives. And so it's an effort that is now in its 13th year, right? We began this in 2012. And we can talk all about that, but I think a lot of the listeners know that, because they've heard me talk about it before. That treats now over 2,000 veterans across the nation. What started out as an organization treating, three veterans in New York City, is now treating 2,000 veterans across the nation. It is an organization that I'm proud to be at. We just had our annual New York City fundraising gala. We raised $4.3 million on behalf of this effort and our veterans. And today being Veterans Day, I'm hoping that, you know, people will consider supporting this cause. I put it out there on my Twitter. I put the link out there in my morning blog. I put it out there on my Twitter. I'll put it out on LinkedIn in a minute. But I just want people who are listening to understand the role that Talia has played in our military, and now it's my honor and pleasure to serve with her at the Headstrong Project. Okay.
Talia, one question. Did you, at Columbia, did you do, or Cornell, Columbia, right?
Columbia, right.
Did you do, were you ROTC?
I was not. No, I enlisted right out of high school.
Okay.
Yep.
So Columbia was after you went
Columbia
to the base.
Columbia was after.
Okay.
Yep. I went back. I was the one that that, you know, all the students thought I was the professor, because I went back and I was, you know, this 25, 26 year old older student, and everybody was confused why I was in class with them.
How did that work? Was it full time school, or you still had to do the other stuff on weekends, or how did that even work?
So I joined the military and I was full time active duty for 6 years, and then I went to Columbia after I got out of the military, and it was just going back to college. I was just a little bit older with a little bit different experience.
all the language training and all that stuff was in the military.
The language training was in the military, and yeah, that was full time. That was an intensive program. So just to give you an idea, I was out at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California. So not too many places that top Monterey for places to be stationed, I will say. So I spent 2 wonderful years out there learning Chinese alongside native speakers. It was really intense. So think like, you know, I want to say class was like 7:30 to 4:30. So all day, every day, learning Chinese in Chinese. So, you know, day one, wow, they encouraged us to stop using English wherever we could. So it was fun, and it was incredibly, incredibly trying, for sure.
Well, the gentleman who was on last Friday, Mike Murphy, he was in Europe. When he enlisted, he said he wanted to learn German. He went to the place at Monterey and learned German, and then he was in Europe for 10, 12, yeah, 15 years. So he actually got the language he picked. Did you, or did you?
Listen,
I sure didn't.
after she studied the Chinese, you know, then she went and she studied, you know, the Afghan Taliban languages, and yep, she spent 4 years translating real-time Taliban communications for our Navy SEALs and Delta Force. I mean, she knows what she's doing.
You know, I was at a birthday party last summer, and I, you know, going off the rails here, one of the gentlemen who was there was a guy in Afghanistan that learned the Afghanistan language, and he just came out of the military, and yeah, he had went to Monterey, and he had picked German too, and ended up with Afghani or whatever it was.
Right. Well, you know, I went in thinking that, you know, I already spoke fluent French.
Okay.
And so I was thinking they're going to use me in Africa, you know, they're, you know, Ivory Coast, whatever. And at basic training, they told me, nope, you're learning Chinese Mandarin. And I did not know a single word of Chinese. So that was interesting. And then, you know, like Kenny was saying, after 2 years of intensive study, you know, I went through intelligence training at Goodfellow Air Force Base, and then they stationed me at the National Security Agency at Fort Meade, Maryland, so right outside of D.C. And I get there, and almost immediately they say, you know, you're not really going to be using Chinese here at my unit, which was the 94th Intelligence Squadron. And they said, if you want to work a really cool mission, and if you want to do really important things, you should go through this Pashto Turbo course, they called it. So I spent about 6 months learning Pashto, and I didn't think anything could be more intense than the Defense Language Institute. But this was wild, this Pashto training course. But I went through, and I actually I did really well, and I came out speaking Pashto. And that was my entire working career, was translating, like Kenny said, for combat operators downrange. So and a lot of times they were those top tier guys, like, you know, Navy SEALs, Delta Force.
Were you do that from here? Or, I mean, this all was done overseas when you were doing all this stuff, right?
I was remote. So, like, you know, that was one of the unique aspects of my job. So we were working remote operations. We weren't, you know, we weren't even, you know, the people kicking in the doors. We were the ones, you know, getting the communications and translating live. for, you know, for those guys downrange.
Wow.
You know, and it was, you know, even still, it was the most intense and exhilarating and rewarding job. But, you know, the whole point really and where I started my Headstrong journey was, you know, this job and me being, you know, one of the only Pashto linguists usually on our missions, on our crews. And a lot of times me being one of the only women, I had this high degree of needing to get everything right and needing to find you know, do everything to, you know, a very high bar. And so that kind of that mentality, that wanting to get it right and wanting to do things perfect and wanting to, you know, save lives, because that was, you know, that was the job. It was saving lives, and it sometimes meant, you know, that we lost our colleagues. It led to, you know, a lot of anxiety for me, and you know, this perfectionism ultimately led to, you know, a very intense panic disorder. Even I was having panic attacks, and eventually these panic attacks grew to just, you know, I would be triggered in every single area of my life. You know, I felt like even when I was it grew to like I could be driving somewhere. I could be in the grocery store, and I'd be just struck with anxiety and a panic attack because my brain would associate something with, you know, something I did on the job. And so, you know, that really grew and grew, and I had to get really good at hiding it on the job. And, you know, I remember opening up when I was still active duty, I opened up to some friends. And, you know, I said, I am really struggling here. You know, my mental health is low, low, low. And they said, hey, if you open up about this, they're going to pull your badge. You're not going to be able to probably ever work in intelligence again. And to me, that was the worst thing in the world. This job really felt like, you know, the greatest job. And it was the greatest job in the world. So that was hard for me. So I let it get even worse. And finally, you know, I was at a breaking point where I was, you know, on the outside, I looked fine. No, you know, again, veterans do a great job of, you know, of presenting themselves with that incredible military bearing and hiding that internal strife. And I did that really, really well too. You know, and eventually it just came to the point where I was so sick. And I was feeling every day, you know, and I don't know if any of y'all here have ever had a panic attack. But you feel like you're dying. You feel like you're out of body. You feel like you're on a psychedelic trip. And you know, that was my life every single day. I would have like 4 panic attacks a day. And so it was eventually time for me to step away. And I thought, you know, I'm going to get out, I'm going to go back to school, and I'm going to kind of step away from, you know, what I thought was an environment that was encouraging, you know, my mental health to unravel. So, you know, for a while, you know, being in the new and having a new mission in New York, it helped for a little bit, but then that panic started creeping back, that anxiety, that, you know, all of the things I was experiencing, my body very much remembered, and it came back full force. And I was working actually for a military news and culture platform called Task and Purpose. And I was with a friend one day, and they told me about Headstrong Project because I was, you know, back to suffering again. And, you know, they said, you are a great you are a great candidate for Headstrong Project. You need to look into it. I had gone through therapy before. I had tried everything. I thought, you know, therapy just doesn't work for me. I am just somebody who's going to have to struggle, and this is going to be me the rest of my life. And, you know, that's you know, it's I just thought of it as a you know, a disease that I just had to live with.
I tell you how similar is this? I mean, I'm not trying to be a doc. How similar is it to this, to what a lot of doctors and nurses and even like my buddy Dr. Jansen, psychologists go through, where you want everybody to be cured and they're not? I mean, it sounds like you know, whatever it is, people that are and primary perfectionists in today's world is a tough job.
Yeah, absolutely. I would think so. I mean, And can you tell me your question again? How I want to make
I'm
sure.
Saying
that
it, I'm saying it's sort of the I've actually talked to doctors, nurses, psychologists, yeah. even some traders, as crazy as it may seem, that have this mindset where they want to be right all the time. And guess what? No matter what kind of a doctor you are, people are going to die, and then they have the same sort of issues. They always could have done more. They always could have done better. And you know, and it's it's probably not, no nobody's the same, but it sounds right. Somewhat similar.
Absolutely, and I think that's one of the reasons. And shout out to our healthcare workers out there. Shout out to our first responders. Shout out to everybody who goes through this. Absolutely, it is very similar. It's just you constantly replay scenarios where I could have done this differently. I could have done this faster. I could have done this better. And if I would have done that, this guy who was a father or this woman who was, who was a daughter, or, you start thinking about all of the complexities of somebody, and you start to think about how you could have made a difference to save their life. And that's absolutely part of it. Yeah, I think that's a great point.
Don't ever decide to become a traitor. It's the same. I could have been long. Why was I short?
Oh, my gosh, I bet. No, I hear that mental health is... can be really challenging there too. So,
but other, there's a connection here that one of the guys was on last Friday, Mike Murphy. His son was in Afghanistan, and he was going from village to village trying to, for lack of a better term, buy off the Taliban and stuff. I wonder if you guys weren't part of the same operation.
Hey, maybe we supported each other. We should connect.
Yeah, it sounds really so. What did the Headstrong people do differently that helped you out?
Yeah. Let me ask you this. If you have ever experienced, trying to get in with any kind of doctor, not even mental health, but sometimes it can be a long waiting period. You call up, you try to get an appointment, and they say, yeah, I can see you in 2 to 3 months, right?
It's horrible. It's horrible now. Right? If you want any sort of a special deal, there's people with, I know some people with heart murmur issues or heart rhythm. Go see a guy in 6 months. For God's sake, you'll be dead in 6 months.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's veterans, when they are reaching out and when they say, hey, I need help, they are at the end of their rope.
For them to ask you, they're already at the day they need it that day because they've been waiting so long before they ask somebody.
That is exactly right. It is usually they're at a breaking point. And that is how I felt. I felt like I was at the point where I would do anything. And I mean anything to get my panic attacks to stop. I was, alcohol only helped so much, and I hear a lot of people who must rely on substances to numb this pain. And, I grew a new level of appreciation for people struggling with addiction and substance use issues because I get it. It is so painful. So anyhow.
Did you make one quick question? Because this was brought up the other day. Was there any sort of a, I don't want to say when you talk about drink, I'm not saying that. Was there any sort of a veterans organization where you landed, for lack of a better term, at the bar and the three people sitting there with you had the same exact issues? Was there any kind of a...
Absolutely.
Before you got to Headstrong.
I meet veterans all the time who are struggling in some form or fashion. Some veterans, I hear a lot of times from combat operators and from SEALs and that kind of group that they don't necessarily struggle from the PTSD and that kind of trauma that I went through. I would have thought, you see your friends die, you struggle big time with that loss. And a lot of times it's not so much those the visions and that particular situation. It's more so like it's the survivor's guilt. It's the loss of identity when they get out of the military. It's the fact that, one day you're doing an incredible mission and you have this amazing job and you're part of a community, and then you're out and you are cut off from that life. Every veteran struggles in a very, very different way. When I was at Columbia, we have one of the strongest military groups at Columbia University, and we're, you know, shout out to the Columbia MilVets. But when I was there, we had about 400 veterans studying at Columbia, which is so impressive. It's
really,
it's,
why? Just just for what reason? Just people do.
Columbia's actually started a really impressive veterans program after. Shoot, I want to say it was after Vietnam.
Okay.
They started welcoming veterans back, and you know, it was part of that. I want to say, you know, now, you know, being in the mental health space, it's part of that healing journey. It's part of getting, you know, getting back to be a productive, you know, quote unquote member of society. It's you know, getting your education and finding a new mission. And Columbia really, really saw the value in that. So shout out.
Is a lot of this GI Bill?
All of the GI Bill. Okay. My education was paid for, and Columbia is very expensive, so I feel very, very lucky to have that. And there, you know, there are some student loans there too, but mostly the Yellow Ribbon program had our backs there.
Hey, Ricky, if Diane piles in, let me introduce her and let her do some talking here, because she knows more about this than I do. If she's in,
copy that. We have Evelyn on the line though.
No, Evelyn's not the one we're looking for. We're looking for Diane, right?
Yeah, well, she'll pile in. If she doesn't, we'll...
Copy that.
All right. There's a strong GI Bill group there.
And really the whole point is that, you know, I met a ton of veterans at Columbia who were going through some kind of, you know, mental health struggle. Some, you know, more intense than others. You know, some even, you know, went on leave and had to take care of their mental health in you know, whatever way that they chose. I felt incredibly lucky to learn about Headstrong. And when I first learned about Headstrong, I thought, you know, this is just another form of therapy. It's not going to work on me. You know, I do not respond to therapy. That was my line. And you know, somebody said, just give it a try. It is free. They do not, you know, it is quick. They have a model that, you know, you get in and you get right to treatment, and it is paperless. So, you know, your medical records are not ever going to be shared. They're not going to get back to anybody, which, by the way, is huge for a lot of times special forces guys who don't want anything on record, right? I went in, I submitted an inquiry thinking, like, I'm just going to give it a try. I don't think it's going to work. But I remember that first phone call. Headstrong got back to me. It was truly, if it wasn't the next day, it was the day after. It was within 48 hours. And I just remember for the first time that care coordinator who was helping to understand my story and helping me get matched with a therapist, for the first time, I felt hope. This person who was lovely, who was a veteran himself and who understood my experience from a cultural level, made me feel like maybe I can get better. He's asking really good questions.
No, is he a private practice guy who donates time, or is he an employee?
He was an employee of Headstrong. Okay, We have a really fantastic team of care coordinators who are trained to do exactly this. And all of them, you know, all of our team is on our clinical side. They are culturally competent when it comes to the military. Many of them are veterans themselves. So
who picks these guys and who trains them to do what they do? Because this is a very specific kind of stuff, isn't it?
That's a great question. That's a wonderful question. So our clinical team at Headstrong Project, we operate unlike any other organization out there. We are rigorous, and we have an incredibly high bar for who we hire. And I wish you could speak to our team directly, because we have such a cool process.
Is there a place, a building where everybody all goes to do all this stuff, or is it?
It's not necessarily that. So we try to hire therapists who you know, number one, understand the military, and who number two are actually trauma informed, who have those credentials to treat trauma. So a lot of times, what I have heard, which I didn't know, therapists will go through school, they'll go through training, and they'll do some work with trauma, but it's not the level of certification that we need to see at Headstrong. You know, they're not necessarily certified in gold standard treatments for trauma, like EMDR, like cognitive processing therapy, like prolonged exposure. Those three are the gold standard, and that's what we need to make sure people understand.
How does somebody learn that? I mean, what psychology school? I mean, where do they come from? I guess, and what age are these guys?
Yeah, good. Usually it's like a certification program, like anything. It's you know, continuing education typically for therapists. So you know, they decide I want to treat PTSD and trauma. You know, some folks want to go into CBT, you know, or talk therapy and rationalization. You know, they want to go through internal family systems. They find a treatment that they think resonates with their practice. And for EMDR, for prolonged exposure, for cognitive processing therapy, these therapies have been shown to be the gold standard for treating PTSD, and especially when we think about veterans who are dealing with really complicated trauma that is oftentimes linked to, you know, even childhood. So, you know, all that's to say, it's education that they decide to take on because they feel that it's relevant to what they're doing. And that's who we try to find. And we try to find, you know, top of the line therapists, and we pay top dollar because we believe in retention. We know that keeping that therapist in place for, you know, every veteran is going to lead to their success. We know that hiring the best means the best outcomes. And I want to give you a couple of stats to back that up. So, I'd love to have you guys guess, you know, if you're thinking about veterans who already struggle getting mental health care, how many veterans do you think after their first session come back after, you know, after that first time with their therapist? Just throw a guess.
I'm going to say the way you guys are doing, it's pretty high.
It's 97%.
I was going to say 90, but I didn't want
unreal.
I didn't want to be an idiot and say 90. I would be wrong.
You'd be like, oh no, it's actually, so yeah. Yeah, thanks for that. No, it's 97%. I think that a lot of people are shocked by those numbers because, you know, that means that people in their most dire moment, people who are feeling like they are at the end of their rope, like they can no longer go on, 97 of those people feel hope and they feel like, I'm going to do this. I can do this. And they come back. And that, I think that is one of the most special numbers that, you know, one of the most special stats about Headstrong. And another fact that I think is really important is that, you know, after their, I want to say after, you know, at the exit survey, which is, you know, once they've completed treatment with us, 89%, almost 90% feel significantly better. And they are, you know, they feel that Headstrong has made a major impact in their lives. That's massive.
Well, how does this work?
Say that about therapy.
Let me
jump in. Significantly better means that they, you know, we take these, Headstrong takes these men and women and gives them their life back, right? Significantly better. I mean, they have their life back. Tell you, right?
Exactly.
They can function again in society. They have a job. They have a good relationship with their wives and their kids and their parents and people around them. It's an amazing thing that Headstrong does. And we do it all with, I don't know if I might have missed this, but all the doctors or clinicians are all independent, right? They're located around the country. They right. specialize in this kind of treatment. They go through a very rigorous vetting period from Headstrong to make sure that they meet the requirement, that they understand, that they've got the right experience, they've got the right knowledge. And that's what I think makes this program as successful as it is, Talia, right? Would you agree?
Absolutely. Yes.
So if the logistics of it, if somebody here, like if Diane has, well, she doesn't come across, say she knew of five people that were right at their perfect for what you guys yep. do. How do you, in Maywood, how do you find one of your people or Great Lakes or someplace?
Yeah, I'd say reach out. So, and I'll give a plug for our website here, headstrongproject.org. Go to the Get Help tab. You know, you fill out an inquiry form. We make it nice and short and sweet. Again, we are all about removing barriers and making it easier for people who need help. Somebody will reach out immediately, you know, within 48 hours. And then on average, we get somebody in, sometimes we get people in that week, which is, again,
when you say in, how many is this nationwide or a bunch of different?
We are nationwide, nationwide. Okay. For yeah. telehealth, and then we are in 17 states plus the Washington D.C.
Are the...
And plus there's a plan to grow that, right? We're gonna be in more states over the next couple of years. I think it's another five states. Tell you that.
Yep.
You know, the
and
plan is to expand into five states, but they, you know, we went telehealth during COVID. Right, to allow these veterans that felt even more alone yeah. to be able to get access, right? But our clinicians are, to tell you, best in class. They're all, like I said, private practice, which gives the veterans a sense of a safe and respectful kind of approach, right? The two guys that founded this back in 2012, you know, Al Rabel, CEO of Kane Anderson, and Dave Petrucco, who's the CEO at Backcast Partners, you know, they felt very, very strongly that, you know, if they're able to go in and get the quality care if they needed it, then why can't every veteran get the same? Why every veteran deserves that same care? And so they were on a mission to start this organization. And today, like I said, we've grown from what was three veterans in 2012 to now more than 2,000 across the nation. So it's an amazing organization, the way that we serve and help these veterans kind of return, get their lives back.
So the people that you're talking about are people that are out. You're not going to treat somebody who's at Walter Reed. That's their job, right?
You sometimes treat active duty in certain situations. So, you know, for example, we have a really wonderful partnership with the Navy SEAL Foundation. So okay. We'll treat active duty, you know, in certain circumstances. What we want to do though is really focus on that veteran who doesn't have the same level of access that an active duty member has. So that, you know, we're kind of a little bit focused in that space, but no, we do serve the population that we serve is massive. So we serve, you know, veterans of all eras. You know, we don't just treat 9/11, you know, post 9/11 vets. We treat every, you know, any veteran who comes to us.
I think the other point that's key to make here so people understand is that the whole idea started and was brought to both Al and David from a Marine, a New York City, Marine, his name is Zach Iskall, who you know was a kid that grew up in New York, enlisted in the Marines post 9/11, went and fought in all the worst places you can imagine, and then came home in 2012 and said that this country is unprepared for what's going to happen. This country is unprepared for these men and women that are going to return. Not even. Besides the physical trauma, they're not prepared for what the mental trauma is going to be. So Zach Iskall, who was very good friends with the other two founding partners, Al and Dave, got together. They started talking about this, and that's when this program was launched and to where it is today.
Well, Kenny, when did that start? How many people came back from the you know Eastern or Western fronts in World War II, and how many of those people were just pile them back in and hope they all drank together and got over it?
Exactly yeah. the right. point, yeah. because prior veterans never, you know, was, look, when these veterans came back from Vietnam, they were, people turned their backs on them.
Well, without a doubt.
It was horrendous, right?
Well, there was,
so, this was not going to be the same after post 9/11.
How do you differentiate? I mean, I don't want to get into the actual treatment part because I don't know what I'm talking about. But Dr. Mark on last week was talking about how different it is for the individual people that have a family, don't have a family, have a job, or just maybe infantry, and they go off and become a mercenary someplace, which you don't want to be. Somebody who did logistics or new languages, like who we're talking to. You know, they have a skill set. Is there differences between people that really just can't get back in society, or there's no place for them to go versus others? It seems like, well, Dr. Mark was talking about it, it's a huge buffet of issues with every person. And everybody,
I think every veteran, you know, is going to experience this in a very, very different way. And I will say, you know, personally, on the outside, you could look at me and say, wow, she's got a perfect life. She's at Columbia and she had the coolest job and she's got, you know, this incredible, I had a, you know, my husband, my now husband, you know, I was in a great relationship. I had a great and a strong family. So I think, you know, it affects everybody, no matter how good you've got it. No matter, you know, no matter your career field, it's just, it's going to hit everybody in a different way.
And she's right, but I think one of the biggest barriers, and we talk about this all the time, I think the biggest barriers for getting care for anybody but veterans now in particular, both the men and women, is that they feel shame, right? That they feel this, there must be something wrong with them, we're trying to destigmatize this whole conversation around mental health, right? We're trying to make this conversation recognize that this conversation needs to happen. It's healthy for it to happen, and that nobody should be ashamed. Things that I've seen out of this, right?
And that's beautiful, Kenny, and I fully agree there. And I think that a lot of the whole, like, you know, the mentality that we've got to keep going and we just have to push through, you know, that's instilled in us right at basic training. You know, we show up and they're like, you can do another mile. You just ran 6, you can run 7. Keep going. You've got this. That's instilled in us from the moment we step foot off that bus to basic training, right? And I think that's something that really stays with us. We're struggling. We're, you know, we feel like we're on this really tough, you know, rock, and we've just got to stick it out a little bit longer. And I think that's what so many of us feel until we are at the point where we are falling apart and we're not going to make it. So I think that's something that veterans, they think, I can push through. I have pushed through impossible things before, and I'm going to do it again. And so that's what we're feeling, right?
Well, I think when you go to I don't know why I always go back to logistics, I guess because I was born this way. When you go to a new area, what's the three-step process? I mean, obviously, if somebody's there, as you've mentioned, they can do Zoom or they can come to one. But say you guys want to go to Idaho or someplace. Now, do you start trying to find a few doctors? I mean, what's the procedure first?
For opening up a new state.
Yeah.
When we want to open up a new state, yes. I mean, it starts with all of the fun, you know, registering to, you know, an entity in that state, of course. Yeah. Then we reach out to partners for, you know, vets. We want to make sure the need is very much there, which it always is. And then we reach out to, our clinical partners, and we start that interview process. We start forming that cadre of really, really strong clinicians who meet our very high bar.
Well, it must basically come from word of mouth. Somebody finds you and has a friend who has sort of the same problem and says, hey, these guys are really good. You got to try them.
Yeah. Yep. Most of what we do, we do not advertise. Most of what we do is word of mouth. And what's really sad is I wish we could advertise, but we are a nonprofit, and we want to make sure that we can fund everybody asking for help, right?
And so that's the key, Tom, to Talia's point. We're not, ever since, you know, the government started some of these cutbacks earlier this year, we've seen this surge in veterans that are coming to us because the VA is the VA can't handle it, and we've seen this surge. And so now it becomes, you know, we have to make sure that we have enough money. We're raising money hand over fist trying to serve these. We don't want to turn anybody away. And so, you know, the more we advertise, then the more we're going to get, which is fine, but then the more money we need, and we're a nonprofit, so we're working hard every day, whether it's foundations, whether it's corporations, whether it's, you know, individuals trying to raise money. This event we just had, we had 900 people in Chelsea Piers in New York City. We raised $4.3 million in that evening in the service, you know, to help these veterans, right? Because now it's not only the veteran, now we've gotten into the veteran's family, wife, their children, because it's as Talia will tell you, it doesn't just affect the one person. The way mental health just doesn't affect the one person, it affects everyone around them. Their kids, their family, their parents, whoever. Right. I tell you, am I right?
Absolutely, Kenny. It affects communities. It affects, I mean, you know, something that I think about all the time is, you know, when we see these, you know, these horrible, you know, the news that comes out that a veteran was, you know, the shooter in this recent, you know, it makes me think, oh my gosh, what if Headstrong had gotten to them? I think about this all the time.
Well, Diane talked last week about the suicide rate, and it's off the chart.
The suicide, yeah, we still off the chart. 17 veterans a day. We still lose 17 a day to suicide. And I want to give you this fact. We have lost just over 7,000 to combat operations. About, I want to say about 7,052, right? The amount, this is a staggering number. We have lost over 144,000 veterans post 9/11 to suicide.
That's unbelievable.
Listen, one quick thing. I think because I'm going to have to jump off. You guys can keep talking. I have another commitment, but I just want to make sure that, you know, we get this out, especially today's Veterans Day, is that, you know, the HeadStrongProject.org is our website, right? You can go there. People can click on it. They can donate. Even if it's $50 to donate something to support our veterans. And you can learn more about what we do. You can see it there. You can see the people that are involved, the doctors, the head clinician. You can hear her story. You can hear the story. There's PSAs on the website of veterans that have gone through the program that talk about where they were and where they are and the work that we did to help them save their lives. And tell you, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, we have saved everybody that has come to us. Do I have that stat wrong?
I had heard that stat too. I want to say we're pretty close, if not, but the impact, our outcomes are truly off the charts. People here, you know, people in the mental health world hear what we're doing and they are blown away.
Right.
True.
We're going to try and pull Ricky. We won't try. Ricky will put this together, what we just did. And he does a nice job, and we'll ship that off to you if you want to use that on the site or whatever, if it helps at all. But we'll do what we can on this end. And we'll obviously tweet out to whatever we can. I'd like to have Talia back, or you, Kenny, because I know you're busier than hell. But one thing that what's happening here in Chicago that's kind of frosting me a little bit is that the more people like you and the people here, like in the food depository and stuff, the more they do, the more it seems like government cuts back. And this little dance that's going on here, to be kind of blunt, is pissing me off.
Exactly. No, 100%. 100%. Yeah. Right?
100%. Okay, the food depository is going to feed 200,000 people. Guess what? We're not going to do SNAP benefits. Well, wait a minute. That's not the idea of this, right? But it can get that way. And it seems like it's sort of getting that way.
Yeah.
Let's get it together, America.
Here's a brutal question. If the person who's having these kinds of trouble, if they don't find you, what help are they getting from the Veterans Association? At all. I mean, there's some there, yeah. I guess, but
I don't mean to bash the VA because there are a lot of fantastic people working there. However, it just the care that I tried to get at the VA was not sufficient. I felt like I was a number, like, oh, this is another one with PTSD. All right, we got to walk. It just felt very like follow the bouncing ball. It just did not feel like Talia Dos Santos was cared for, right? Like that I mattered. And that was radically different at Headstrong. And what's really cool about Headstrong is, you know, again, like you come in and they learn you, they learn your story, and they tailor treatment to you. And it's just, again,
radically different. You get the same person most of the time, so you're not spilling your guts.
I have the same therapist for 2.5 years.
The person has the same therapist. There's definitely a connection because there has to be, right? You can't have a different person every time. So there's definitely, it's the same person that's helping you through the process, right?
And that's why we pay we are above average for how we do that intentionally. So they want to stay. And another thing we do is we give clinicians, if you're a clinician out there, we give clinicians cases that they really want to work on. We really try to fit you with something that, you know, that really matters, that you're really passionate about, that you think you can make an impact on. So it's a beautiful thing how our clinician team works, and I cannot shout out.
Is there a main place? I mean, is there, if you had like a biggest office where people come in,
No, because we don't have physical offices, right? Okay. What we don't do is spend the money we raise on buildings and put our name on it and say, come on in. There's none of that, right? We work independently with clinicians that are located around the country. Unlike other places that, you know, build buildings, we don't do that because that's not what it's about.
What percentage of the veteran? Is a clinician your employee, or is this 20% of his or her practice, or how does that work?
No, they're not. The clinician is not employee of Headstrong. They are a provider.
Yeah, they're like a contractor for us.
They're a contractor.
So you find the best guys. Someone like my buddy, if he was retired, but like Dr. Johnson could have done that in Hanover. He could have had
right on.
Okay,
correct.
Actually, what he the veterans home there in Hanover, wherever the hell it is, he claims the guy there was the first person who really got an internist degree and a psych degree. He went through twice, and he was, to the extent that the veterans group does anything like this, was kind of on him. He was one of the lead guys that the veterans even addressed this problem 40 years ago.
Wow.
So, and he ended up being on the board in Washington and wherever the hell the veterans board is.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, that's kind of the connection of all the people. Isn't it amazing? At one show, we had all these people involved in this. It's kind of crazy. But
I love it. And still, the need is so high. We've got so many people working toward this, and we still have this urgent and very dire need.
Tell you, is there a bigger difference when people have a job to flow in through versus they don't? I mean, my cousin was Vietnam and he had all kinds of issues. Yeah. And when he came back, he really didn't have a skill. And then he was a bouncer and a bartender, and it just never kind of worked. I would think if he came back like as an accountant and went and got a job and had a 9-to-5, not that that's a great thing, but I suspect it would have been easier on him, but I don't know. I'm not a doctor, but it just wasn't easy on him. He had no skill set to fall back on.
That's a really interesting question. And honestly, I would imagine that the more barriers, the more obstacles that are in your way, I think you might experience things to a more intense degree. So it may be just a little bit harder if you don't have a job, if you don't have a loving family, if you don't have a home, if you're homeless, and I would admit, but you know what? One thing that I want to just emphasize is even people who have it, good on the surface, they are still unraveling.
Right.
It's a complicated answer, but
right.
Yeah.
What is the
understand too that a lot of these, what I've learned is a lot of these veterans who spend their life in the military, when they come out, Talia, right? That some of them find it very difficult because they because that's what their life was, and so that adds to the stress, and so that's why this is so important to bring them back, to give them their lives back, and help them move on.
And some people feel and bless them. Some people feel that they're, just a specific example. Somebody might feel aggression issues, and they might feel intense anger and grief. And right. They feel like when they erupt, when that comes to the surface, they might harm a family member. So that might, they may look like, oh, they have a loving family, but they may be deeply afraid and ashamed of the fact that they feel like they could harm one of their family members, Right. So it is so complex, and there's a lot, going on for vets who, I almost wish that, I think in a dream world, I would love for Headstrong to be able to be there during that transition period, because we know that when veterans get, are about to get out, and the first 90 days after, that is their most vulnerable moment.
It has to be.
It is an identity crisis a lot of times. Vets are 2.5 times more likely to take their lives within that 90 days there. So it is my dream to, build a partnership with the military and just have a feeder program, get with Headstrong after you get out. And let us help you, right? Listen, like, how amazing!
Tell you
that
what is. What was the psychological mess ups in the World War II generation where you came home, basically drank for 6 months, then never talked about it the rest of your life? What the hell? Yeah. What was that all about?
Yeah,
was called
pushing it under the rug, right?
Yep, all under the rug.
Excuse me 1 minute. I just have to jump on. You guys can keep talking. Just make sure at the end that somebody gives out that call to action one more time, so
we will do that.
Who may want to participate can certainly help us.
Yep,
anyway,
I'm good for that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate
Tell you if you want.
I would love to stay on, but I have to jump. You guys can keep talking.
Thank you, Kenny. Big hug.
Tell you, I'd love to hang on for at least another 10 minutes at a break. But also, if Hal, if you're on the line, if you have a question, Hal is a veteran of the Navy. He was on a nuclear cruiser for a while.
Oh, Hal. Badass.
Yeah.
Very cool.
My daughter has a name that's similar to yours, Talia.
Oh,
And she's one of
are triplets, and that name means dew of God.
Yes, it does. Hebrew. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So
yeah, there's a couple different ways of pronouncing it.
So at least you're dealing with your stress differently than Hal, which became an Austrian economist. Look what happened to him.
A pragmatic Austrian economist. Pragmatic, which makes me probably a de facto monetarist.
You're a closet monetarist.
That's what this
well,
is.
It'd actually be better for my career if I was a monetarist than a pragmatic Austrian.
That's because nobody knows what it is.
Wow. Yeah, you guys, I speak a lot of languages, and I have no idea what you're saying right now.
There's different schools of economics, and there's the Keynesian school, there's a monetarist school. Which
I'm teaching a history of economic theory class, and
nice.
There's so much disagreement amongst economists. Everybody kind of thinks when they take an econ class that all economists think alike, but I took over a macro principles class for a professor who's on family leave because he just had a daughter, a baby daughter, and he's on family leave. And his style of teaching and his economics are different than mine.
Sure.
Not much, but they're different. But then within our department, we have Keynesians, we have people who would probably think Milton Friedman is, you know, like prophetic.
That would be me.
Yeah. So there's so much disagreement within economics. That's why when you watch the news or the financial news, and there's two economists debating the issue, they can't agree because we agree on very little. There's very little that we agree on. It's crazy. And you don't really think that when you're in econ class. I mean, in econ class, you had upward sloping demand, downward sloping supply, and then macro, you know, you got GDP. You know, so people think that it's this unified theory, but there's so much diversity in it that I think that's one reason why people think it's dismal.
Well, hell, yeah. you've been listening in when you, whatever the term is, mustered out, they used to call it back in World War II. When you left, when the day came and said, "See you, hell, we don't need you anymore," or you escaped or whatever, was there any?
There were guys on my ship that when we got to Thailand, they went UA. They stayed in Thailand.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Yep.
I actually contemplated jumping off the ship and swimming back to the Americas when we were stuck in the Persian Gulf for like, I don't know, 35 straight days. The seawater temperature was 30 or 98 degrees. We had a distilling plant that was broke. We were on water rationing. We were eating off paper plates. We couldn't take showers.
Ooh.
The ship was like 120 degrees. It was like a sauna. It was like,
oh, I don't know.
I bet it smelled great too.
It did not smell. I mean, my mattress, which was 2 inches thick, was soaked with sweat because it was so hot.
Oh.
It was soaked with sweat. And the stay time in the engine room was like 3 hours. And you'd take your logs, you know, you'd read all the temperature gauges, and you would go to the ELT shack, the chemist shack, where they had an air conditioner. And you basically sit in there for 2 hours, and then you go take your logs, and you come back. And you take your logs and you come back. So you spent most of the time in the ELT shack, like four of us, because it was so freaking hot. And to this day, I cannot stand humidity. I mean, I talk about it. I'm obsessed with it. I analyze football games with it, like when West Coast teams play in the South. I mean, I'm just obsessed with humidity, and it just makes me uncomfortable.
When my buddy
Don't
Mike...
Don't run to Florida, Hal.
You know, the funny thing is, before I was on the ship, I was in Florida, and I love Florida. But, man, I go to Florida now, and I can't be outside.
Yeah, stay in the AC.
Well, Talia, you mentioned, you know, people coming out. When Mike Murphy was on. I think he retired as a captain. But when he left, he said they give you this huge physical. I mean, maybe because he was an officer, I don't know. And they compare it essentially with the physical when you came in, to try and figure out if you're going to be hitting them up for any disability, and a lot of people have some disability. Is there any mental side of that at all, or is it totally physical?
You know, from what I remember, they do a very brief mental health screening. And that's kind of like where I first had this idea that, oh, I do have a little bit of PTSD. I remember thinking that to myself. But it was, you know, it was kind of like a checkbox thing. And they were like, all right, move along. You know, it really felt like a, you know, again, just I'm checking the boxes here, and I didn't feel like, you know, that there was this urgency that there really is with mental health.
Yeah.
What the, you know, it's funny when you, I talked to a bunch of people, you probably figure out just from a few minutes we've talked. There was a young lady, I talk about a wacko story, a hand surgeon that hangs around in my neighborhood bar, right? Good looking guy. And once in a while, these ladies would come in, I guess, for stress relief, for lack of a better term. One of them was Indian, a couple of them were Japanese or Japanese American. And I was talking to the Japanese American lady, and she worked for the Chicago group of Center Disease Control. And there were a couple of things that had popped up here that they were trying to find. I don't know if it was a new flu strain or what it was. But she was really involved in that. And you could just tell by talking to her for a few minutes how intense she was. You know, her uncle was writing a book about her grandfather was interred during the war in a camp here.
Oh,
and so,
wow. Was,
so the next week, I said to Dr. Billy, I go, what's her name? And he goes, she's probably in rehab. And I go, what do you mean rehab? He goes, well, she doesn't do any drugs. She only has a couple of beers, but she's so intense in her job, she gets so stressed out, she has to go on rehab every once in a while.
Wow.
So it almost sounds like, you know, that could happen to doctors. It can happen, and it sounds like what you were saying, Talia, about your personality, how you wanted to be perfect in an imperfect job. I wonder if that's the way you are. I'm a little bit like that, too, to be honest. Well, maybe not, but, I mean, no matter what job you have, if it's almost going to affect you, whether it's Army or not.
Yeah, I definitely feel like I need a little tune-up here and there, for sure. And you know, especially after I had my children, it felt like, you know, everything. It's interesting how stress begets stress, right? Do you all feel that way? Like when something stressful is happening, it seems like, you know, you are remembering all the stress that has ever happened to you, and it's all coming to the surface again. So, you know, absolutely, I see that, and I do. I feel like, you know, from time to time, I just need a reset, and I need to practice self-care here and take care of my mental health. I don't know. Do you all feel that way?
We're not a doubt.
Well, my stress is relieved in my work because I just love my work. Right now, I'm doing these Marxist models, and I'm trying to I've come to some conclusions that I thought I'd never come to, but I put myself in Marx's shoes. What world did he live in? And I have come to the conclusion that he wasn't critiquing free market capitalism. He was critiquing state-created monopolies, state-protected monopolies, the mercantilist system, the feudal system where people were just considered machines, you know, just serfs. Ooh. Most people, most commoners, most serfs were just machines.
A number?
Noble lords.
Maybe not even a number.
But that's the world Marx grew up in. And his dad had to convert from, like, Judaism to, I think, Lutheranism. To avoid persecution.
Yep.
And you really see Marx's rage in his university poetry, where he literally wants to kill God, because the Prussian king was supposedly of divine right. I mean, it was a Christian kingdom with a Christian king, and that state forced this system of oppression on all these people in Prussia. And you really see the effects of that system that Marx lived under in the TV show 1883, which is a prequel to Yellowstone.
Yes.
The Germans that are on that trek.
This is the one with
they don't
Sam
know how to swim because it was illegal for them to swim.
Is this the guy with Sam Elliott? That's the one with
That was with Sam Elliott. Yeah. Yeah. And the guy that plays
Taylor Sheridan, right? Taylor Sheridan show, right?
Yeah. The guy that played the sergeant was one of the Marine Corps people that was corrupt in the Terminal List series on Amazon Prime. He plays an awesome sergeant. He's a black sergeant that is serving Sam Elliott.
That's the guy who was his sidekick, the black guy in 1883?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So he's so good. Both Elliott and him are so good in that.
But it
shows you how oppressive the world that Marx came from. And if I grew up in Marx's world, I probably would have came to the same conclusions. The thing is, I think if Marx grew up in my world, I think he would be more like me, because we're probably both grumpy, up and down, And we're both probably contrarians. We're both have problems with trust and authority, which may be in the Navy really difficult.
Okay, hey, you know, we are all products of our situation and our time, right?
Yeah, I just gained a new, and that's, I think that's what we need more of. We need people on the left and the right to put themselves in the shoes of somebody on the left.
They're not smart enough to do that.
Somebody on the right.
They're not smart enough to do that. We don't. I'll be nice and say that the skill set needed to get one of these political jobs is not the skill set you need in the job.
Oh yeah, I know.
Was that nice to you, how I just said that instead of saying
that's
something?
That's a good way to say that.
That was beautiful.
People who tend to tell fibs because they're seeking power are the ones that are drawn into politics.
Well, it's because
Tom, I got a question for you.
Go ahead.
How many people? How many people in the Senate and the House bought stocks at noon on Friday, knowing that this shutdown is going to be over the weekend?
Probably most of them. Anybody who's got a brain. Well,
740% increase in 1.5 trading days.
Well, we're 800 points in the Nasdaq since noon.
Yeah.
And when you come on the show, we ask you like really wacky questions.
I love it. Fire away.
If you had a politician, say in the White House or an aide or someplace, and he would, and all the stuff that comes out of the White House that is, well, it's always come out in politics, but this guy's put it to a new level in terms of, shall we say, tradable announcements.
That's his nature, right? He's gonna offer the crazy.
Well, but whatever it is, it's middle, you know, the Fed used to do it, and you know. But my question is, would you rather have somebody there who is very crooked and is taking advantage of it, or somebody there who's so dumb he doesn't realize what he's doing?
Oh God!
Well, I don't think any of these people are dumb. I don't think Nancy Pelosi's dumb, and yet her portfolio.
Well, but you know that's a whole
trading information.
You can't even. This is, as you can probably tell, Hal's from the conservative side of the aisle.
Well, I'm not conservative. I'm pretty radical libertarian. Okay, so Republicans are as off-putting as Democrats to me.
Okay,
so.
but to compare.
But I do like their free market rhetoric, which is just that.
Which is just rhetoric.
Yeah, it's not free market.
But to even compare. The Pelosi portfolio over 40 years of investing in stocks.
It's not just Pelosi.
So what I'm saying is that to compare the Pelosi portfolio over 40 years versus front-running Friday's stuff is light years different.
Yeah.
It's not even on the same page. Yeah. I mean, I could have made more on Friday than Pelosi made her whole life if you gave me the number.
Trump and other property developers benefit from the Fed and the Congress creating these huge budget deficits that have to be financed. It is great for business. All that money flows to these other countries. They use these trade deficits. A trade deficit results in a capital inflow, and that capital inflow helps push up stocks, real estate. So all these people like Trump benefit from this system.
He's the government and property owners are the single biggest beneficiaries of inflation.
Exactly.
Yeah. See the stuff you learn on this, Tully? Let me tell you.
I want to take a class from both of you now.
The weird part is, I mean, Hal has his background, which we'll talk about on veteran stuff, is more important than mine. But mine was I came out of the monetarist school at the University of Chicago, where I actually had a class with Milton Friedman and a couple other guys.
That would have been awesome. I would have paid money for that, man. That would
the guy.
Cool.
The guy's about 5'2".
I know.
And I was 6'4". We say next week I look pretty. But
he was tiny in that acceptance speech in Sweden for the Nobel Prize in Economics. Remember when he got booed by that one guy?
Yeah. He also had to stand on a stool, I think, or something, or on a box. I went right from there to Pullman when I was doing the inflation stuff for a railcar contract, and I did all the escalation clauses of even know what those things are, because nobody has those anymore. Back the inflation was so bad in those days that people, if you were a professor even, if the inflation was 12%, you got a 12% goose in your, if you were a union person, you got a 12% goose in your wage before you even talked about anything else. Everything was just escalated. So It was a different sort of, and I also did tax returns for people, and I learned very early on that every time you have inflation, people bump up tax areas where you're now paying 12% instead of 10, even though the money that you're making now is worth the same as last year. So the government does very, very well on this stuff. So there's, well, there's a lot of conspiratorial stuff we talk about on the show, as you can probably imagine from your small, tiny bit on here. But I'm curious, the one poll I'd like to have you back on, it seems like, how do you fill up when you get let out of the military? Where do they even let you out at? I mean, how do you close the 90-day gap you talked about, Kelly, earlier?
Ooh, that's really interesting. When you get out, you out process, you do like all your final paperwork, and it's just kind of like, goodbye. And that's hard for somebody like, when I was at National Security Agency, I went from having a really cool job with a lot of access to being, not persona non grata, but you know what I mean? Like, I'm out and I have no more access to that, to my community. I can stay friends with my friends, but there's really, what am I going to do in Fort Meade, Severn, Maryland? I can try to get a job as a defense contractor. And there's like mental health implications there too. And, in the finding work, especially right now. But in those 90 days, you can rest. Hopefully, in the military, sometimes folks have what we call terminal leave, where they, bank up a lot of those, paid time off days. And you can, maybe spend some time with people you care about, hopefully.
Do you qualify for unemployment?
Are you eligible for unemployment? Yeah. I believe, yes, actually.
You are, okay.
You are
all right.
Eligible for unemployment. That's right. Yeah, you can do that. For some people, though, that money, it's helpful in that you can pay your rent and you don't have an additional stressor. But, a lot of people are still faced with this identity crisis. What am I going to do? Who am I? What do I even like? I've met a lot of people who get out of this kind of work and they feel like, I have to start all over again. And, I have to relearn so many things. And one thing that you'll hear from military is like they go from doing what they feel like is really mission oriented work. And they are, saving lives and, XYZ. And then they get on the other side, they feel a lot of times if they take a corporate job, they're just working to, and I've heard this so many times, to make rich people richer.
Well, without a doubt.
So that mission can be, they feel like that's not a mission. I'm just like working to fill time and to pay my rent. So like there's a lot that goes on there. So I think finding meaningful work.
Did you have any friends out of the military?
Did I have friends? Yeah. I maintained a lot of my friendships, but I, I knew I was going back to school. And so I left all of my very close circle in Maryland. My husband and I went and stayed with my family in Florida for a little bit. And it was just weird. It just felt like, this weird limbo. And there were definitely some, identity questions there for me. And there was a lot of fear there. I was, at the time, I didn't realize how young I was. I was like 25 and I was, thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going back to school with 18-year-olds. They're going to think I'm a loser. So, there was a lot going on there when I got out.
Hey, well, Hal, when you got, I'll use the term tossed, when you left, where were you? They let you go in Florida and your home was in Idaho? I mean, what was the gap?
I got out in Washington State and I was planning on going to college. I was going to use my GI Bill to go to college, but I had like 3 or 4 months. So I signed up for a thing called JTPA, which is an unemployment program in the state of Washington that allowed me to collect my unemployment benefits for 6 months while I was in school.
Where'd you go live between then and college for 3 months?
Well, I moved in with my mom,
okay.
But I was 25 and I couldn't live with her anymore because I was a man and she kind of treated me like I was still 8. Oh. So instead of living with my mom, I moved, instead of sleeping on my old bed, in my old bedroom, I preferred sleeping under my brother Rod's pool table, which was in the living room of his apartment. Instead of having furniture, he had a pool table with a TV. So I'd rather sleep under the pool table than stay in my mom and dad's house.
Did you want to stay? I'm curious. Did you want to stay under the pool table instead of on top of, because you were like, were you on a bottom?
Well, Rod would have killed me. Rod would have killed me for causing his pool table to warp. So I suffered. Right. But I made the most incredible chicken fried steak for him. It was like, it was about a half inch of meat with like 2 inches of coating. Fry in a pan was really good.
Tell you, don't judge all economists by Hal.
No, I like Hal. Hal, we'd be good friends.
Oh, man, I'll tell you, one of the
problems... I don't know what that says about you.
Well, I think one of the problems with the PTSD in the military today is that for the guys I was in on the ship with, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of them, when they got back to the... there was a guy that I knew that when he got back to Bremerton after a six-month Westpac, he jumped on a bus. We were in San Diego. Our home port was Bremerton. He jumped on a bus in San Diego, rode the bus. And this is while he was still in. He rode the bus all the way to Bremerton and then checked himself into the mental institution, the mental hospital.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I think what happens is when you sign up to join the Navy, for example, I just know the Navy experience. When you sign up, you're trying to get away from a small town with no economic hopes. And maybe most of the guys I was, you know, in with, they were looking for training that would get them a really good job at a nuclear power plant. I was in the nuclear power Navy.
Sure.
Or they're trying to get into college, and that's what I signed up for. I signed up for college. And I felt like I was lied to by the recruiter. He told me that, oh, the nuclear Navy, it's going to be high tech. It's going to be unbelievable. Well, I wasn't allowed to be a reactor operator. I was slated for mechanical operations, which meant that I was basically an underpaid, way underpaid in terms of market value, a valve mechanic. I mean, I basically just cleaned valves all day in the steam plant of a nuclear power plant, and I felt lied to.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So that creates, and then you can't get out of it. You are indentured at, and I calculated my wage at the time. I was probably making 45 cents an hour because we were working 3 5-hour nuclear power plant watches a day on the ship.
Yep.
In addition to that, we were working an 8-hour workday. In addition to that, and that workday was 6 days a week, and the watches were 3 5-hour watches a day or two 5-hour watches a day, 7 days a week for the year while we're underway. And then on top of that, we had 2-hour engineering drills on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and we had nuclear engineering drills on the other days. And then Sunday was an off day, but you might have had 15 hours a watch or 10 hours a watch. So I was getting about an hour and a half of sleep a day. And oh, I was like, man, I calculated how much I was earning per hour, and it had to be about 35 cents an hour.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
That is the reality. And then when we were in port, it was even worse because we had our 5-day work week, 8 hours a day, but we had every other day, we had a 24-hour duty day. And then the mind games.
Well, what's a 24-hour duty day? What, I mean, you got to be on the boat all day?
Well, we had a man that shut down nuclear power plant. So on our 24-hour duty day, we had, I typically stood 15 hours of watch every other day while we're in port, and worked my 5-8-hour work day.
What are you doing? You're just watching. I mean, literally just watching it.
Taking logs, walking around the plant. Yeah.
Oh.
And then on Saturday, you'd get off duty at 7 o'clock in the morning if you had duty on Friday. You'd get off. You'd muster at 7 in the morning. And then they would release you all day Saturday. And guess what? You had the day off Saturday, but you had to be back to the ship by 4 in the morning to get 2 hours of sleep after partying in Seattle all night. You had to be back to the ship by 5 in the morning so you could shower and then stand another 24-hour duty day. But that wasn't enough. When we mustered at 7 in the morning on our day off on Saturday, the officer of the deck would walk through our berthing and say, these berthing rooms where we all sleep are unsat. So you know what we'd actually literally do? We would pull the equipment out, the buffers and the mops. They'd be in the P-ways, the passageways of our area where we slept. They'd come through and walk around and make sure that we were working. And we would stand up real quick and look like we were mopping and buffing. And then they would leave. And then they'd come back an hour and a half later. And then we would just basically sweep and put things away. We didn't do any waxing, any mopping. And they'd come through and they'd go, this looks good. And I came to the conclusion that they're just literally playing this power game with us. And it was infuriating. And that's one reason why it fueled my anti-authority views that I had before I joined the Navy. It made it even worse, which is probably why I love being a professor, because I get to do my thing. Nobody tells me how to teach. Nobody tells me what to teach. I can say I want to teach this, and they'll let me teach it, and I get to teach it my way. Nobody micromanages me, and I freaking can't stand being micromanaged. It just drives me nuts.
You listened to that on Friday. Mike Murphy joined up after his college degree.
And
he had a list that he was going to go to officer school and all this kind of stuff. And there was a list of stuff he was going to do for them and they're going to do for him. He goes, every single time that they were supposed to do something for him, he had to fight it. It just didn't happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Because one of the things we fight a lot with some of the people on the show, you can only imagine some conservative people on the show, where it's all about this immigration thing, right? And I said, you know, there's an awful lot of people that have been honorably discharged with the promise of being a citizen that never got the citizenship. And of course, you know, some of the real right-wingers we have will go, yeah, they never went through the process. But after listening to Mike on Friday, that doesn't surprise me at all. He said he was supposed to go to language school like you did. They weren't going to send him there until he said, hey, where the hell's my language school? So it doesn't surprise me at all that the day that these people get their discharge, there's not a citizen piece of paper in the envelope either. It seems
all the foreigners that I knew, the ones from Mexico and the ones from Canada, when they were discharged, they got their citizenship.
Well, there's a bunch of them that didn't.
Wow. There should be a path. There should absolutely be a path to citizenship. And I think that from a national security standpoint, and I'm not trying to get political here at all, but from a national security standpoint, go ahead. If we're promising, for example, when we're overseas, when we're in Afghanistan, and we are promising to keep our Afghan partners safe and their families safe if they help us fight the Taliban, and if we say, hey, you've got a path to citizenship in the U.S. if you help us, and if we go back on those promises, they are not going to help us in the future, and they are probably going to try to help, for example, the Taliban. Yeah. We have seen that. It is really bad for us.
Oh, yeah. So I agree with that 100%. Yeah.
We've been lying to people for how many hundred years? It's not new.
Yeah, the lies go back. The lies go way back. I mean, the lies go back to the Constitutional Convention, where Hamilton literally wanted the states to be provinces of not the British king, but a permanent crown in America. Mm-hmm. That's who Hamilton was. And so I think from the point the Constitution was ratified, there's been a group of people within the United States who have always wanted to turn us into a European-style monarchy or mercantilist system where the state creates...
How we're doing it right now.
I know exactly, yeah. Well, we've been doing it for 100 years. I mean,
well, we're talking about this as a... Tell you, this is an economic thing. We've got you walked into... We've taken you into this well with us.
Hey, I'm a cousin. I'm a political science major, so I know a little bit here and there. But the technical stuff is wild.
Well, what we're seeing here, in one man's opinion, and I think Hal would agree, and we both try and fight against it all the time. Yeah. We're moving into a fascist economic system.
Sure. Corporatism.
It has nothing to do with. Because I did some lecturing in Germany in 1990.
It's a system that Marx hated.
Yeah, well, it's essentially two or three companies in every industry with their nose firmly up the ass of government, basically.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, the NFL is a cartel.
Yeah.
Tom. Yeah. The NFL is a cartel.
But I'm saying they're not. They don't have the get out of jail free card as a monopoly like Major League Baseball does, and yet they act like it.
Yeah.
But anyway, I did some lecturing.
There's different phases of cartelizing, right? But they are a cartel, especially when they keep competitors out.
I'm saying, but they're not a legal one like baseball.
Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, when I was in Germany in 91...
They're a gray market cartel.
Yeah. the banks owned a lot of the stock of the big companies, I tell you, and the banks were real close to government. So the chances of the three of us getting a company and being able to break in are like zero. But now you're seeing that here. I mean, in every industry you can kind of name. We're not a free market economy. We are in maybe 10 areas. Agriculture, barbershops, bars.
I wouldn't say we're free market in agriculture. There are so many subsidies.
But the individual farms, they own their own stuff. Yeah. I mean, it's your barbershops. You know, you got to have a license to be a barber. I mean, I get it. There's all these little intrusions, but it's not the same as, the military group now or... How many combinations have there been in the military in the last 20 years? Like 50?
Yeah.
I mean,
you got the pharma cartel, you got the banking cartel.
Yeah. I mean, how many?
You got the health industry is a cartel.
I'm a little older than even Hal, and I can name you big drug companies that if you don't have a memory, you don't even remember.
Yeah.
You know, Squibb, people like that. They're all been taken over by somebody. Forest
yeah,
Labs.
This Ozempic thing has just got me furious.
Oh, without a doubt.
I mean, let me ask this question. Do you think a drug company who is cartelized by government with other like-minded firms who have these patents and those patents give them monopolies and the government protects those monopolies and the government promotes the monopolies through its marketing of FDA approval, do you think these pharmaceutical companies that produce these drugs, do you think they're going to create a fat drug that you can take for a month and never have to use it again and lose the weight?
No.
No, they're going to build a drug where if you stop taking it, you're going to gain the weight back and more. That's what they're going to create. And we're going to lower the price of that. And RFK Jr. or the MAHA movement within the Trump administration is celebrating this drug being available to everybody at low cost. To me, it's just a way to secure a company that produces a drug, a lifetime customer.
Well, sure.
Because if they go off the drug, now they're going to gain the weight
back.
Nobody wants
a cure.
Yeah.
they
don't want to find cures.
You know, it was going to be the greatest drug ever, and then somehow, I don't know why it blew up, but it did. This is maybe before your time, tell you. It was Rogaine. Rogaine was going to be for guys that were bald, or shall we say follically challenged. Is that politically correct?
Follically challenged.
You know, but you were going to have to use it every day for the rest of your life for 100 hours a month.
They're not going to invent a drug where you take it for a couple weeks.
No, and then you're cured. To hell with that.
Now, if we got rid of the patent system, if we literally got rid of the patent system, people argue, hey, if we were to the patent system, R&D will disappear. And I go, no, that's a lie.
That's
it
total
will
lie.
Not disappear because there are people out there who are passionate about biology, who study biology because they want to find a cure for something. And it's going to actually create a system of lower prices, higher quality, continuous innovation. And you won't have these companies designing drugs that you have to take for the rest of life. Otherwise, if you go off of it, the consequences are you'll return to that previous state, but it'll be worse. You're going to be fatter if you go off this drug.
So tell you,
or
you
lose all the hair that you gained.
Do you want a lot of people from the armed forces that have problems turning out like hell?
I think one of the problems with the armed forces is it's voluntary, but man, the salaries and the promises are way below market.
And you get killed a lot. And you lose legs and stuff.
But
you know,
this kind of highlights the fact that we never want to return to a draft, because I think the problem with the draft is you mix people who in the same group of people, the platoon or whatnot, that there's two groups of people in a platoon. There are the people who didn't want to be there and are being forced to at the end of a gun, and those who volunteered for it. And the people that don't want to be there really pull down the morale.
I would actually... argue that, of course, we argue all the time, so we do on the show. I would say that some sort of a national service with maybe a basic training, and
if you want people to serve, pay them their market wage.
I know, but I'm saying then.
And don't want.
Go ahead, Talia.
Well, here's a thought. When I was in, I obviously the pay. I think my first paycheck was like $495, which was a lot to an 18-year-old. You know, to a 19-year-old. And one thing that I'll say is that
did that cover rent? Can I ask you if that covered rent?
Well, I was in the barracks, so this was kind of like my little pocket change. But when I, you know, eventually when I made like staff sergeant, you know, I was doing pretty well, and I had BAH and BAS, which is basic allowance for housing and basic allowance for subsistence. So they paid for, you know, they gave me a stipend for my rent and for food on top of my salary. So I felt, to be honest, at the time, and I'd have to look at the numbers now, but at the time I felt pretty well taken care of, and I was living in a beautiful.
Tell you, now here's the rub with that.
Yeah.
On our ship, yeah. Only the married people got that.
Yeah, right.
The single people had to live on the ship.
The poor single people. No, that's true.
Because they're living on the ship, guess what happens when they're sleeping on their day off? They get woken up to work.
Oh yeah, it was rough in the barracks.
That right there creates animosity between the single people who had to live on the ship, and the married people who don't have to be bothered with being woken up at 4 o'clock in the morning because they're at home in their nice mattress.
Even at when I was at DLI, you know, at training, this is even before I started my real job in the Air Force. But when we were in training, the married people got to live off base. They got paid extra, and the single people, just like you said, we had to show up at formation, you know, and on an extra day. We had so many more requirements. We had to keep our room super tidy. We had, you know, inspections. It was just
there's no inspection of a person's apartment who's living with BAQ.
That's right.
Yes, right off.
That's
base.
Right.
Kelly, did you ever
totally different?
Were you ever in planes?
Was I ever in plane? You know what's funny is I grew up in aviation, and that is why I joined the Air Force. But I was grounded the entire time when I was in the Air Force, which is so funny. But I worked remote airborne operations, which means that all of our collection. So I worked intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. So our collection was all airborne, whereas our operations were out of National Security Agency.
The reason why I ask is our Thursday guest Lou Michaels went to Air Force Academy, and then he went to law school at Duke, and I think he might have been a pilot, but he never but he did reconnaissance. He was an electronic warfare guy flying around like Russian stuff. We want to get back here, we got a dash pretty soon, but I want to give you another shameless plug here, but also he said the amount of cancer for fighter pilots that were up, got a gazillion hours up in the
Radiation.
Yeah, the radiation. Plus, Diane, hopefully she's okay, she didn't call in, but she said the incidence of cancer from Vietnam vets. And of course, you know, our government, you know, I love the place, obviously, but we do have our warts. I tried to do some research on that. And of course, the only place I could find it was from South Korea. South Korea helped out. They had a lot of people in Vietnam fighting on our side with us. I don't know if people remember that or not, but they did. And the incidence of cancer is like 24 to 29% versus of the people who were in Vietnam versus weren't. So the stuff with the, there's a huge intertwine here, which maybe next time around we'll talk about, between the physical problems and the mental problems. I mean, you see, when I used to jog, go on a lakefront, and you'd see people running along with no legs. And obviously, they somehow found a way to deal with whatever happened to them. I would guess Afghanistan, but I don't know. And other people have other problems. And I wonder, is there this interplay, next time we'll talk about, between physical injuries and the mental injuries? Obviously, it probably makes it worse, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The more obstacles you're facing, the worse it's going to be for you, for sure. And you know, this, speaking of like all the different cancers and the different eras of veterans, this generation, the post 9/11 generation of vets, we're dealing with burn pit cancers. It's just terrible. I know several people who have very lasting damage. So one of my good friends from when I was young, and he had some kind of horrible, horrible cancer from burn pit exposure.
Oh,
another really good friend, dealing with just chronic like lung issues. I mean, the burn pit stuff is really, really terrible. And our government is still having a really hard time, let's put it nicely, addressing this.
Well, it took years for Agent Orange.
Right, right.
Well, funny you should mention that, because we have a listener of the show. She wrote a text to me and said that she knows somebody that she just knows. I don't know how she knows a guy from Denver, and he's a big burn pit issue, and said he's just a mess.
Mm. Oh yeah, yeah. Our ugh, it's terrible.
It's really awful. But the real last comment. Then, as long as you get your plug in, and we gotta have you back. But I was at a funeral in Marengo, Illinois. It's kind of a weird deal because a body came out to the cemetery. There was no... Anyway, I'm hanging in the cemetery for a little while before the body, the hearse, showed up. Sounds so weird. And I just, being the goofball that I am, I start looking at all the headstones. And everybody's got the World War II in this area. Every guy, 57 years old, 55, 52, 61, once in a while you'd see a 70. I mean, those dudes all died young. I mean, obviously they were smokers. They did, God knows what they did, but you start seeing, 30 graves in a row, and every person is in their 50s, and everybody served. You're sitting there going, this is not a new phenomenon. Maybe he just died earlier enough we didn't have to take care of him or something, but this is not new. I mean, obviously, unfortunately. Just saying. That's not a happy note, but all right, give a, how can people send money? What's the website? And
oh
you, and,
gosh.
You, and you have to come back.
Thank you. Yes, you guys are the best. I'd love to come back. And thank you so much for the exposure to Headstrong. We really need this, and I think what we need most of all right now are our supporters, whether that's, you know, if you are a part of a corporation that, you know, you're a defense contractor or you have a veterans employee resource group or a large population of veterans, you know, corporations can really help us right now by partnering with us. And there's a lot we can do to collaborate. But we are looking for corporate partners, we're looking for foundation partners, and we're looking for individuals who feel passionate about this cause. We desperately need donations right now. Our need is up 20% from just last year. So you all know, cuts to the VA, you know, the employment market being what it is, it's a particularly...
Well, you guys never actually got money from the VA, though, did you?
No, to my knowledge, we don't get any money from the VA. I don't think it's off the table. But right now we are privately funded, and we're funded by, you know, we have some really great partnerships with, you know, I mentioned the Navy SEAL Foundation. We love them. We've even partnered with incredible organizations like Wounded Warrior Project in the past, and we hope to do that, you know, again in the future.
Let's have you back in. I guess we got to ask Hal too next time.
Hal, thanks for your service, my friend.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Hal's the best.
Thank you for your effort.
Hal, thank you for your service. I meant to tell you that. I apologize, but thank you.
Oh, thanks, Kenny.
It sounds like Kenny. Oh, Kenny,
I jumped back on.
All right, we got a dash. We're over.
I jumped back on because my wife said it's still going on.
Well, you know what? Listen to these two go at it. It's been a riot for me.
Yeah.
SP Futures down 15, NASDAQ Futures down 122. Guys, it's fun, and I hope we did some good. Hope we opened up some minds here, and we'll do it again. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.